Colonel Coffrey, Reel 3.
Well, it was almost night then, so we assembled everybody together out of their positions round Panham, and I started to lead the way back to Fayang, when another galloper appeared out of the night to cancel the first order and tell us to get back to our positions. Well, this was rather irritating and also confusing, because by that time it was dark. But I waited in the open with my British Sergeant Major until I thought that everybody had understood their orders and were getting back to their positions. And just at that moment, there were several shots, a burst of automatic fire, and two grenades going off very, very close. And I thought, good Lord, what's happened? And I was very alarmed, because I knew my soldiers were very vulnerable, because the sections wouldn't have been yet back at their posts, and would have been wending their way, probably some of them rather last, through the village. But nothing further transpired. So Sergeant Major Kitt said, better get back, sir. So we went back to where I had my headquarters, and there we found a lot of very nervous-looking Africans with bayonets fixed. I wasn't going to send out any runners that night, because I thought the Africans would be in a rather nervous state, and the runner might easily have been shot, as his fellow soldiers might have thought he was a Jap. And we had no walkie-talkie radios at that time, so there was no other means than by runner of communication with the platoons. So we sat it out that night, feeling rather cold, because we left our blankets behind at Thayang. And at dawn, we had a single shot. A couple of minutes afterwards, one of my platoon commanders appeared and said that there were two dead Japs in his area, and that he'd last killed his best corporal, a chap called Ibrahim Maidugri. I remember his name. And I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, I didn't know last night. I couldn't find out. I should mention that this young platoon commander had only very recently come from England and didn't know Hausa, or very little of him. Anyway, he'd gone to see, he'd gathered what had happened, more or less. Apparently this corporal and the Bren gunner with him had blundered into a couple of Japanese who perhaps saw us leaving the village and were sneaking back. Anyway, the Bren gunner had shot both the Japs, one of whom appeared to have been blown up by his own grenade as well, somehow. But they'd managed to shoot and kill our corporal. So the platoon commander took me and a few others of my headquarters to go and see the corpses of these Japs, and they were the first that we'd seen close up. The dawn shot we heard was my platoon commander finishing off one of the Japs who tried to throw a grenade at him. Now this, I thought, would be the chance to show such African NCOs as could be spared, because nothing was happening at that time, to show them what the Japanese looked like. So I collected a party together and took them to view the corpses. Then they could see the Japs, what the Japs looked like. They could see their uniform, arms, and so on. And this went down well, because at least the Africans could see for themselves that two Japs had been killed for one Nigerian, which was a good start. But the African Sergeant Major took it very hard. He was a man who roared like a bull on the parade ground, and all the Africans were much in awe of him. But the sight of the two Japs, dead Japs, unnerved him completely. You could see it from his face. And for the rest of the campaign, he was virtually useless. But we were very careful to give him no opportunity to explicitly fail. He didn't fail, but he was an unnerved man. The sight of death, the sight of the dead Japs, were too much for him. And you could see it in his face at the time. His eyes stared, his lips trembled. It was very surprising.
Were they a particularly gruesome sight?
They were a gruesome sight indeed. One had all his guts spilled onto the sand with a light film of dust over them, and the other one had a spongy stump left of his arm. He, the one that tried to throw a grenade at my platoon commander with his other hand. But what struck me about them was their dead faces were not in the least yellow, they were white as paper. Well, so 35 column had covered themselves with glory under Peter Vaughan, but we'd done very little. But the next day, when Calvert was with some of his Gurkhas and British columns were going to make yet another attack on the Japanese lying near White City, our battalion's task was to set up a roadblock on the track or road that led from White City south, very near the railway line. And Peter Vaughan gave me 29 column for this job because he'd already been in a fight and we hadn't. So we found a suitable ambush, a position on the road. We'd already heard a Jap truck when we were approaching the road, driving down furiously. And so we crossed the road rather gingerly, taking all precautions against being seen by any other Japanese truck. And then I set the roadblock, which was really a roadblock come ambush. And we set it up. I set it up. Everything was fine. All my men were ready posted, very, very close to the road. Chaps with grenades within 10 feet of the road. And the rest of us not much further off. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we had a lorry coming. Now there was a little stream and a ford about 100 yards to the north of us. And I reckoned that this fellow would slow down when he came to the stream and change gear. But I didn't intend to loose my Vary pistol, which was the signal for everybody to open fire, until he was opposite us, where we couldn't possibly have failed to stop the truck. However, it had only got as far as the ford, when to my fury, somebody fired a Piat bomb. Now, a Piat was a shoulder-fired anti-tank weapon. The bomb exploded about 10 yards short of the truck and outside of the stream in the sheriff's park, and immediately six little figures looking like brown beetles scrambled out of the truck and rushed up the hill along the road. Our shots raising dust all around them, but none of them, as far as I could see, hit. And we had the truck, and that was all. And I was very, very angry. And I shouted in Hauser, "Who fired that Piat?" And to my astonishment, it wasn't an African at all. It was one of my platoon commanders, who had been convinced that the Japanese, who slowed when he came to the fort, had seen us, was about to turn around. I was convinced that he'd done nothing of the sort. So it was, shall we say, some altercation between us. But I was thoroughly disgusted because I thought, well, the men rushing up the hill away from our bullets would have told everybody else. And the next thing we'll see is a party sent to dislodge us, not unsuspecting lorries who'd fall into our ambush. However, so I'd really almost written off the whole idea of an ambush. However, the next day at dusk, we heard not one, but several lorries grinding towards us very slowly, again from the north. And this time, everything worked all right. They came slowly, slowly, just as dusk turned into night, they came slowly towards us, and evidently there was a party of Japs walking on the road, because we could hear loud voices. They were probably hearing about our abortive attempt of yesterday. They knew approximately where we were, but not exactly, and were probing the road for mines, so that they, of course, kept advancing, then stopping, and the men kept shouting, until they were directly opposite to us, within feet. And this time, the very light, not fired by me, but by one of my platoon commanders, who'd been very carefully briefed, went off at exactly the right moment, and every single weapon in the column opened fire. And you lost yourself in noise. The leading vehicle was soon flaming. You could hear the small arms ammunition popping off inside it, and you could hear groans from the men in the lorry, from the Japs. This was after I blew my whistle as loud as I could to stop the firing. Well, there was nothing much we could do that night. But at dawn, I sent out a couple of platoons and more Europeans than were needed, really, in order to give the Africans confidence. I told my company commander, Dickie Lambert, to mop up, which he did. We lost about 4 or 5 men killed, but the Japs lost 42, including those and we collected all the bodies. We had 6 trucks, by the way, 5 or 6, I can't quite remember. And I got my soldiers to pull the bodies out of the trucks and as many as possible, as many as they could readily find of the Japs killed that morning off the road by Dickie Lambert and his party. And we laid them all by the side of the road like bundles of dirty washing. We had 3 prisoners. One appeared to be ill but unwounded, and the other 2 were badly wounded. And I was telling the Africans not to murder them, but to take them up to our position. The Africans, I may say, were very puzzled by this paradoxical desire to save the lives of enemies. Well, I was telling them this when suddenly there were loud shouts just behind me. So I spun round, and there was a Jap NCO in the back of one of the lorry who'd shaken off the hands that were trying to drag him from the lorry, thinking he was dead, and was brandishing a bayonet and had tried to shove it into the nearest African. His tunic was stiff with caked blood, and he looked exactly like one risen from the dead, until one of my British sergeants shot him dead with a pistol. Well, that was our first engagement, and a successful one in the end. After that, we were in for a long time, 5 months, which was about 2 months longer than Wingate intended to keep any chintid column in Burma. But I'm bound to say, through no fault of our own, that compared with many other columns, both British and Gurkha, we didn't do a great deal of fighting. We had a number of skirmishes. We lost a number of men, 1 or 2 officers, but we didn't do as much fighting as many other columns. But that wasn't our own fault. It was the luck of the draw. For a time, we remained with Calvert, and he liked our battalion and wanted to keep us with him. But in the end, he was forced to surrender us to join the West African Brigade, or rejoin them, which we did near White City. We then had a very long march north through the monsoon to a huge lake called Ndorji Lake. And we had numerous skirmishes, one fairly full-scale fight, and eventually we marched to Mogang, which by that time had been very skillfully and bravely captured by Calvert and his exhausted columns. And from there, we went by jeep railway to Michinar, which had also been captured after a very long time. There were months when we were told by the wireless it was to be captured any day, but it never was. But in the end, the Japs withdrew. And from Michinar, we were flown out to India. By that time, Dickie Lambert and myself were the only two out of nine British of the original company, which I commanded before I commanded the column, and this company formed the main fighting part of the column, and we went in as nine Europeans strong, and we came out with two, Dickie Lambert and myself. And the rest of the column suffered proportionately, many more sick, I may say, than wounded. And by the time we did fly out, we were in a very exhausted state. We'd all lost a lot of weight. We'd been short of rations a great deal of the time, and we were very tired men.
How satisfied were you with the performance of your Africans against the Japanese as a whole?
I was more than satisfied. I thought they did marvellously. Now,
can I ask you what you thought of...
I've got a bit more to say about the Africans. The ordinary Nigerian, he didn't question much. He trusted his white officer or his white sergeant completely. He never complained. He never abandoned hope. But he just went on. And he seemed to keep alive a faith and a confidence that all would turn out well, which his seniors at times had all but extinguished their faith. And there were times when most of us thought that Burma would eventually have the bones of all of us and we'd never get out. So they sustained hardships extremely well, and the worse conditions were, the more cheerful they seemed. The great thing about the Nigerians, as opposed to ourselves, if nothing was happening, if they weren't being threatened or weren't hungry, then they never worried. They didn't think much about the past or the frights they'd had in the past, and they never thought about battles to come. They weren't being shot at the time. The Japanese weren't bothering them, so why worry? And that was their philosophy. Some provision of nature allowed them cleanly to wipe out all memories of suffering or danger. One must remember that thousands of miles separated these men from their homes in the orchard bush or the savannah or the desert scrub, from their women, their palm beer, their feast days, their black feudal lords, the emirs. They found themselves in a forbidding country, pitting themselves against strangers, completely irrelevant to them, of people they hadn't known to exist. And they couldn't have had any quarrel at all until we made our quarrel theirs. The Japs, of course, were very martial, ambitious people, more than willing to die for their emperor. But the Nigerian soldiers were lovers of peace, basically. They had no urge for self-sacrifice at all, and they fought simply because they promised us when they enlisted that they would, and they did.
What were the main sources of suffering for the Nigerian troops in the Burmese jungle, would you say?
I would say that man for man, the Nigerian troops suffered less from sickness, certainly than the British, and possibly less than the Gurkhas too. They were naturally very robust, hardy people. But what they did suffer from, as all of us suffered from, was malaria, hookworm, and worst of all, a very nasty disease called scrub typhus. And quite a few died from that. Several Europeans died from it. Others nearly died. And there's no cure, or there wasn't any cure at that time for scrub typhus. The only cure was careful nursing, which was the one thing that they couldn't get. And once the fever had subsided, it left the sufferer very depressed. And one or two Africans shot themselves, a thing they normally would never have done, almost unheard of for an African to commit suicide. He'd will himself to die, turn his face to the wall and die, if he thought he was a subject of witchcraft. Oh, yes, but actually doing away with himself was very rare. So we lost quite a lot through that. And then there was general malnutrition, undernourishment, and so on. Now, exactly what proportion of my column, for example, what proportion of the rank and file were evacuated, I couldn't say. I didn't keep figures. But compared with many other columns, it wasn't all that high. And the vast majority of Africans who flew in also flew out at the end, without having to go out in the meantime. Of course, there were long periods when we couldn't evacuate any casualties at all, and they had to sort of follow on behind. And in the end, when we were rather static for a fortnight or so, towards the end of the campaign, they were kept in a sort of fairly safe place, some miles away, with doctors and nursing orderlies to look after them, because there were no chance of making a light plane trip. And as soon as the rain started, which was in late May, there was almost no chance of making a light plane trip anywhere, because so much of the ground was waterlogged. I should have mentioned the monsoon earlier. It started in May and it went on till the middle of August, and beyond that, but we were evacuated about the middle of August. And that was a greater enemy and a worse enemy than the Japs, because it could make life completely miserable. We were soaking wet every day. The sun came out and dried us for an hour or two, and then it would rain again. Sometimes it was worse, sometimes it was better, but we were always wet. And we had an awful job getting up these very steep hills with torrents pouring down them. And the mules fell all over the place all the time, and very frequently the things we carried on our mules, such as machine guns and mortars and wireless sets, had to be headloaded by the Africans to the top of the hill, which they always did without any complaint. How the British troops managed, who couldn't or didn't headload, I don't know.
What was the Africans' bushcraft like in terms of tracking and making themselves at home in the jungle?
Oh, they were marvellous at making themselves at home. As I said earlier, they didn't try to fight the jungle. They surrendered to it, more or less. They adapted themselves to it. And we had a few Karens with us, who were our intelligence chaps, and they taught the Africans a lot about how to make beds out of bamboo a foot above the ground and this sort of thing. And the African got very skillful at rigging himself up, especially if we were there in the same place for a few days. But if it rained really hard, no matter how well made the bed, they'd be soaked. The Europeans were luckier, and we had dropped to us about June, I think, jungle hammocks, American jungle hammocks. We had waterproof tops, waterproof bottoms, and mosquito net sides with the zip fastener, and they were marvellous. They were a bit invidious, you know, one felt a bit guilty using them when the poor Africans were still sleeping on the ground or just above the ground. But none of us had the courage to do away with them. We used them and were very grateful.
You said before that the Africans were complacent about the Japanese.
Oh, yes.
The toughness of the Japanese.
Yes.
When they actually came into contact with them.
Oh, they weren't then. Not at all. After this ambush, which I described, I got together all the African NCOs I could in order to praise their work, which they'd done very well at the ambush. They'd maintained perfect discipline. The only shot that shouldn't have been fired was by a white man, not a black man, and there were over 400 black men. So I told them they'd done very well, and I was proud of them. But I emphasized that future battles would be much worse, so they mustn't be complacent. And then I said, now what about these Japs? You all said, oh, we'll make hay of them. They'll be just like the Italians. Now, maybe you've changed your mind. You've seen the Japs. You've seen that they can fight. And they had to agree. They said, it is so, yes. The Japanese are indeed very wicked. Terrible hard men. Very wicked men. What a pity to keep any of the prisoners alive. So, in the end, they came to respect the Japanese as fighting men.
But could they understand the Japanese fanaticism?
No, never, I don't think. None of us did, actually. We just knew that most of them, 90% of them, had gone fighting to the last man and the last round. And they did.
Did you hate the Japanese?
No. We didn't think of them as men. We thought of them as a sort of abstraction. Sort of jungle creatures, spirits of the jungle, who it was our job to destroy. We never thought of them as men. We'd very little evidence of their, of our common humanity. It was only towards the end of the campaign, when I looked at the photographs we found on a Japanese body. There was one of his sweetheart with white flowers in her hair. There was one of an old couple sitting on a bench who, presumably his parents, and another one of a young officer in a brand new uniform with his curved sword at his hip, who perhaps was his brother. And I looked at these for a long time, and it wasn't really until I studied them that I realized that, after all, the Japs were human beings just like ourselves in many ways.
Did you ever pity them?
Did I ever?
Pity the Japanese?
Not a bit, no. Not a bit.
Can you tell me, all these years after you participated in the Burma campaign, what your attitude is towards having been in it? Do you think it was all worthwhile or not?
Well, of course, the ironic thing was that we fought for nothing, really, because within 3 years at the end of the war, Burma became independent. But I did think at the time I was sorry for the